The following is a special presentation of Alpha Media. Welcome to Beyond the Headlines. In-depth interviews on topics of concern here in Portland and the Northwest. Now, here's your host, Brett Recap.
Thank you, and welcome in to the 427th edition of Beyond the Headlines, a behind-the-scenes look at some of the stories making news right here in the Pacific Northwest as we move through this month of July 2022 on all seven of our Alpha Media Portland radio stations, including FM News 101. Let's talk water, one of the basic requirements of life for us humans. Yes, here in the Pacific Northwest, we are pretty flush with water, especially in the Portland metro area in Southwest Washington. We get plenty of it, but it's still critical. It's a limited resource, and conserving water, especially here in the summer months, is something we all need to think about. With some of that in mind, let's hear a conversation I had with Bonnie Cushman, the outreach coordinator with the Regional Water Providers Consortium. That's the group celebrating 25 years that's involved with the water we all drink and use here in our Portland metro area. They have lots of clever ways we can learn about water usage in our households and find easy ways to conserve. You can go to regionalh2o.org right now to learn more about things like weekly watering numbers. I've also posted a story at kxl.com. So grab a tall glass of water or fill up your water bottle. And let's talk about H2O with Bonnie Cushman with the Regional Water Providers Consortium.
Water is definitely one of the best drinks of the summer. And it also makes a lot of other fantastic drinks.
Great point. It's funny because my son, who's 15 now, drinks water exclusively. It's kind of crazy. He's also a bit of a water snob, and we like our water that we get. We were in Southwest Portland. We now get it from Beaverton. But all around the Portland metro area, you really want people to think about being wise with water overall, yeah?
Yeah, we are very fortunate in this region to have amazing sources of drinking water. And I had to chuckle when you were talking about your son being a water snob. We just got back from vacation and my 7-year-old daughter is also a water snob. So we had to bribe her a little bit with drinking the local water where we were because she was so used to our fantastic water here.
We are quite lucky around this area and in the Pacific Northwest for that matter. So when we talk about making sure that we're all aware as we move through these summer months, and it's going to get hot as summer eventually hits us here as far as the weather is concerned, but are you trying to take the guesswork out of deciding how much water when it comes to both inside and outside use?
Absolutely. And you know, in the summertime, when most of the time it stops raining, and it looks like it's going to in the next couple of weeks as well, the greatest waste of water is outdoor watering. And so we have a great service called the weekly watering number, and we send it out via text and email each week. And we look at the weather in your zip code and we tell you how much to water each week based on that weather.
I like how you've watered that down. I'm not going to say that that's a bad pun, but I like how you've broken that down into numbers and ways that we can all understand and easily refer to. So what is a weekly watering number?
Yeah, so we recommend in inches the amount that you should water each week. So we'll send that out, like I said, via text and email. But you know, you'll have to do a little bit of homework before you can actually use it. And what we're having you do with that homework piece, it takes about 10 to 15 minutes. You run your sprinkler system if you have one. And what you're trying to figure out is how much water your sprinkler is putting out over a given time. And then that'll help you figure out how to use the weekly watering number. And you can do the same thing with a hose as well. And we have information on that on our website. So once you know how much water your sprinkler system or your hose is putting out, then you can use the weekly watering number. And you can put together a weekly schedule. So for example, you might water on Saturday and Wednesday. And by doing that, you actually know how much water you're using. And especially during these cooler or rainy times, really paying attention to the amount of water that you are using is going to be a fantastic way to conserve water and have a beautiful, fantastic garden.
Yeah. And you're talking about all things outside, right? Whether we're playing in the water, we might be washing our car or giving precious water to either our lawn or some bushes or the garden. It's all generally the same because you're still dealing with your hose where a lot of water comes out. Did you say 5 to 7 gallons a minute? Is that right?
Yeah. And sometimes even more. So just putting a hose nozzle at the end of your hose so that the water's there when you need it, but it's off when you're not using it. That's a fantastic and easy way to save water, whether you're hand watering a garden or, like you said, washing your car by hand.
How about those lawns? We do like our lawns to be nice and green and lush. But do you have any tips for us to use a little bit less water during the seasons?
Yeah, so I think the best thing I can tell you is, again, you want to water deeply, but infrequently. So that's where we get back to Wednesday or Saturday watering. You can pick whichever 2 days a week you want, right? So do what makes sense for your schedule. But by doing that, you're really putting the water down by the roots. And by doing that, you're also making your roots stronger. So if you're away for a couple of days and you don't have the chance to water your garden, your lawn is going to have stronger roots and be able to pull the water out of your soil more effectively. It's a little counterintuitive, but just stick with the twice a week watering and that'll help make your lawn stronger.
As we get into these summer months here in Portland and Southwest Washington and really all around Oregon, we've talked a fair amount about outside, how to be smart with our water usage outside. But inside, I don't care what month it is, right? We need to think about things there. What could you tell us, I don't know, about the toilet and some other ways to keep an eye on that water usage?
Absolutely. So the bathroom is where we use the most amount of water inside. And everybody has a toilet. So we always love to start with toilets. And sometimes with toilet leaks, you can tell that it's leaking, right? It's burbling or it's making a little hissing sound. But a lot of times you actually can't. They're silent leaks. And so what we recommend is that you check your toilet for leaks twice a year. And you can get water tablets that'll help you do this from your water provider, or you can use good old-fashioned food coloring. And for those of you at home with kids, this is a fantastic thing that you can bring your kids in to help you detect leaks at home. Everybody likes to be a little leak detective.
Oh, that's cute. That's a good way to get the kids involved. How about washing dishes in the old sink? You ever thought about maybe using some kind of tub or something where you're not just running the water from your sink as you pre-wash your dishes or wash them by hand?
I'm glad that you brought this up, because one of the conversations that I have with people, my neighbors or my family or just folks out in the community, is that many people think that washing dishes by hand is more efficiently. And usually it's not. And the reason is because kitchen sinks can use about 2.5 gallons per minute when they're flowing. And so if you think about it, having that water constantly run is a great waste of water. But the good news is that you can use water efficiently either by using your dishwasher. Most of them use about 10 gallons of water per cycle. So that's less than 4 minutes, or about 4 minutes worth of having your faucet on. So it could be a real water saver just to let your dishwasher do the work. Or like you said, if you don't have a dishwasher, putting a tub in that rinse cycle so that you're just having the water on when you need it to get the dishes washed, and then you can use that tub to rinse them off.
Yeah, my mom taught me that one. I'm not going to lie, because it's remarkable. Do you find that some people are surprised at how much water they might be wasting when they don't even think about things like that? And then you show them, or you put a tub underneath it and you're like, wow, that happened fast in 5 minutes.
I can't tell you how many times I have that conversation at barbecues around the summertime and family get-togethers. Absolutely.
Yeah. How about our clothes, Bonnie? We need to wash our clothes. Any tips there for our laundromats at home or on the go?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think the biggest thing that you want to do is just make sure that you're washing full loads, or if you're not washing full loads, some washers have the load or cycle adjustment for the amount of water. But remember, you're using energy when you're doing either dishes or laundry. And of course, you know, you've got wastewater. So if you're doing that at home, you really want to make the most of it each time you're running your dishwasher or your clothes washer. So doing the full loads is going to be your best bet for being a water and energy saver.
Portland, again, we're awfully lucky. We have terrific quality of water here. We certainly get our share that falls from the sky. If you live in Las Vegas or a desert area or something, that is a problem that's going to have to be dealt with, certainly, as we move down the road. Okay, Bonnie, let's talk about the Regional Water Consortium. What is that? Close to 24 agencies coming together.
Yeah, so the Regional Water Providers Consortium is comprised of 25 water providers, and we are from the city of Sandy to the city of Portland, all the way out to Forest Grove and down to Wilsonville. So most of the Tri-County area, and we've been working together. This is our 25th year. We work on stuff like water conservation and making sure that the public knows how to use water efficiently. But we also do a lot of emergency planning to make sure that we're more resilient with emergencies and disasters. And then any way that we can use resources efficiently so that we can pass those rates, those savings on to ratepayers. That's the work that we do. And we've been really happy. It's just a great example of how government is working well together.
We'll take that. We hear a lot of the negative in that realm, but it's good to hear some good news, especially when you're talking about water, which is one of the basic needs as a human. How about emergency water, Bonnie? Anything we should think about there in terms of having something on hand, or what do we do in an emergency, or how can we prepare?
Right. So in this area, we are recommending that people store 2 weeks worth of water. So that's 1 gallon per person per day for 14 days. And that's mainly so that we can be prepared for a large scale earthquake, but it also will come in handy with winter storms or other emergencies. And we really recommend that you start small and build up over time, because it is a big ask, but the best thing you can do is start storing water today. And then if you do have water stored, you know, you want to make sure that you're changing that out at least every 6 months to a year. So if you're a camper, you know, take that emergency water with you this summer when you go out camping. And then when you get home, make sure to sanitize the containers and put it back into storage.
Okay. We know that thinking about water conservation is really an all year deal, but as we move through July, it's front and center right now. So is there anything we haven't spoken about that you want to make sure and say about water and how much we enjoy here in the Northwest and conservation?
Yes, we are running a promotion right now. If you sign up for our weekly watering number, we are going to send you either a hose nozzle that you can put at the end of your hose, or we'll send you a couple of watering gauges that'll help you figure out how much your watering system is using. So we're happy to send those to folks through the month of July.
How do we do that?
Yeah, just go to regionalh2o.org and there's a sign up right there on our homepage, and they're limited one per customer, but we're sending them out through the month of July. The other thing I would say is just make sure that go to regionalh2o.org. We've got tips on how to save water indoors and outdoors, tips for preparing for emergencies, and about 18 how-to videos if you're looking for things on how to do any of the actions that we talked about today.
Nice. That is Bonnie Cushman, Outreach Coordinator with the Regional Water Providers Consortium, just literally scratching the surface when it comes to water usage and conservation in and around our Portland metro area. Our thanks to Bonnie. And again, you can go to regionalh2o.org now to learn more. Also, see the story at kxl.com. You're listening to the 427th edition of Beyond the Headlines. I'm your host, Brett Rekamp. The city of Portland wants to change how its government works. So commissioners assembled a group to come up with a plan, which they did. But this is kind of a three ideas in one type of plan. And one of the three has to do with ranked voting. Political analyst Dr. Jim Moore with Pacific University says this could cause some people who might want the change to vote no because they don't like that part of it. Have they overcomplicated this? Well, here's a conversation I had this week with Dr. Moore. Where are we in the politics of this Portland charter deal?
Well, we're hitting up against the legal deadlines. That's the clear thing that's going on right now. And the legal deadlines are when groups like the Portland Business Alliance, but other groups have been thinking about it as well. It's kind of their last chance to delay or have things rewritten. Remember, with ballot measures, sometimes statewide ballot measures go to the Supreme Court, which says you have to rewrite the title. Those kinds of things. So we're at those deadlines. Are they important politically? They are right now for those groups, but they're not something that's a big part of the conversation. The more important thing to me is that there was basically very little opposition to the Portland Charter Commission as it was going through. People were saying, yeah, Portland's in trouble. Yeah, let's change the government. Portlanders have done this time and time again, going back 70 years. And what happens is we come up with the proposal. So we got the proposal now. We've had proposals 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 70 years ago. And when people see the actual proposal, they say, oh, that's not going to work, or it's going to have unintended consequences. That's the conversation that's going on. So regardless of what happens with these deadlines, it sets it up for the election of saying, you know, we do need to change things, but we haven't really thought through this part of it, and that would be bad if we passed it. And so, like for the past 70 years, all of these charter proposals are defeated at the polls, basically using the same set of arguments. So that's exactly where we are right now.
Yes. Each voter is almost like a representative. They might not vote for a bill, even though they like the bill, just because one portion of it is something they can't live with or don't understand. Is that kind of how it is?
That's exactly it. Exactly. We're seeing something similar in Congress right now with the Senate saying, do we vote on a bill that focuses on X, or do we focus on a bill that focuses on X and somebody put Y in it? And so Joe Manchin, for instance, from West Virginia, looks at all those and says, oh, no, 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 no. We're in effect exactly what you just said. Each voter will look at it and say, oh, this is too big. Oh, I like these two parts, but not this part. Oh, the unintended consequences, I can see where this might go wrong. And all that has to do is sow doubt in the voter's mind, and the voter's going to vote no.
And it was a group, right, that was brought together that came up with this? Was it 20 people or something like that?
Yeah. The Portland City Charter Commission, basically put together by the city. They put together a cross-section of people from the city, and they looked at a whole bunch of ideas that were out there. And they came up with the plan they did because they said, you know, you can't really disentangle getting rid of the commission form of government without putting in place, for instance, a better way of electing people in the new city council. So they're saying it's a single issue. It's all part of it. Other people look at it, including people who are on the commission, and say, you know, it needed to be three different parts that we would vote on. If one of them failed, we'd still have change. That'd be great. But that's not what happened. And so it's that doubt that's out there right now.
Understood. Mingus Maps, I believe, is one of those who is against this because of that reason. Is that right?
Exactly. He articulated that reason. He's especially nervous about the voting kind of thing. As he puts it, we have experiment on top of experiment on top of experiment. I disagree with him. All of these parts of the Portland City Charter proposal, all of them are thriving in other parts of the country. Some of them even have all three of them together. It's not an experiment, but in Oregon and Portland, change is tough. Change is tough.
Is it too confusing for voters? Just that portion of it, because it does require just a couple of seconds of like, okay, this is how it works. And you do have to follow along. Is it too confusing for the average voter?
You know, it probably isn't, but the campaigns against it will make it too confusing for the average voter. And we see this time and time again. That's what ballot measures do. Remember, it's harder to get people to vote for a ballot measure because that is change. Easier to get people to vote no because that keeps things the way they are and the way they understand.
Great insight there from political analyst from Pacific University, Dr. Jim Moore, on Portland's efforts to change its style of government. Voters will likely make the final decision in November. Time for a couple quick stories from the KXL staff. First, lots of people go missing in this country. It's estimated that 500,000 are on a missing list each year in the U.S. alone. KXL's Mike Turner tells us there's an app for that.
It's called the Q5ID Guardian app. The verified volunteers enlisted through the app can begin looking immediately when a subscriber reports a loved one missing.
So the volunteer portion is free for everyone. The Guardian subscriber, they're the ones that pay a monthly subscription to be able to create profiles for their loved ones and also issue alerts. But both are super easy. And even once you have that profile created, it's just one tap of a create an alert button and to issue that out.
Q5ID's Alexander Harlan says Portland has the third highest rate in the United States of people who go missing. After its launch here in Portland, Seattle and Las Vegas will be next before it goes nationally. Mike Turner, FM News 101.
A big check is coming to a group that works with young people in the juvenile justice system. KXL's Zachary Barnes has more on Working Theory Farm in Hillsboro.
The nonprofit was one of nine organizations selected by Washington County to receive funding from President Biden's American Rescue Plan to assist with workforce development. Henny Sullivan with Working Theory Farm says they will use the money to develop and make permanent its transitional employment program, which works with youth at the farm as they're transitioning out of the juvenile justice system.
That work can both be a source of income and stability and a safe, familiar space as youth are transitioning back to the community. And it can be a place to work towards any other goals and do work on communication, work on goal setting, work on awareness and being part of a team.
Sullivan mentions one story of a repeat offender who they made a concrete plan with to avoid trouble again. He slowly began working at the farm more and is now a crew leader helping other struggling youth to find their goals. Zachary Barnes, FM News 101.
Finally, if you haven't heard about a pesky little beetle creature called the emerald ash borer, perhaps you should. This little half-inch long bug is about the size of a penny, but it's doing a whole lot of damage to Oregon and our forests, specifically ash trees. KXL's John Eric Smith caught up with Scott Altenhoff with the Oregon Department of Forestry this week to talk about this invasive insect doing a number on forests and lands.
We've been anticipating the advent of the emerald ash borer. It was first discovered in Michigan back in 2002, and since that time it has spread to 35 states, predominantly on the East Coast and in the Midwest, and it has made it as far west prior to coming to Oregon as Colorado. So we thought we had some time. There's the natural barrier, the Rockies, and we thought it might progress to Idaho or one of the intermediate areas, but here it is, here in Oregon. And it's bad news for our native ash forests and woodlands because it really decimates the population of ash trees in forests that it's impacted back east. Up to 99% of those forests have been put in peril and been brought to the brink of extinction, actually. So many native ash species are really threatened. Here in Oregon, we rely on the Oregon ash, the Fraxinus latifolia, to keep our streams cool, to prevent erosion in riparian areas. We don't have quite as many urban ash trees lining our streets as cities back east and in the Midwest had, but it will still take a very serious economic toll.
So not just a natural toll, but an economic toll.
That's right. And in addition to losing millions of trees and to lose the services that those trees provide by way of keeping our streams and rivers cool and anchoring the banks of the rivers and streams and helping support plant and animal communities in areas that have, say, next to busy roads or in cities, is going to be an expensive undertaking to remove those trees. Once they're infected with the emerald ash borer, they become very brittle, and one really doesn't have the luxury of leaving a dead or dying ash tree in place if it's next to a high target area. So we will have to act, and we will have to devote precious limited resources to their removal and replacement. Another toll that it's likely to take, there have been numerous studies that show that communities impacted by the emerald ash borer are experiencing health consequences in their human populations as well. And we've known for a long time that the presence or absence of trees has an impact on human health and well-being, and that's about the last thing we needed with the pandemic still underway. So, but like the pandemic, we don't have a choice. We've got to deal with it, and our task is to do so efficiently and not shy away from whatever we're facing. And my approach is we'll deal with this like we deal with all challenges, and we just have to align our efforts. We have to do things efficiently, and hopefully we can bring to bear federal resources and broader state resources so that we're not just doing one-offs here and there. The bad news is that this pest has not been successfully eradicated in any of the areas that it has appeared. So we've tempered our expectations and are hoping to contain it and limit its spread and kind of flatten the curve, as it were, with regard to rather than having all the costs come all at once, if we can spread it out over the course of a decade plus, that would help us budget and plan and conduct operations a little more efficiently. If folks have noteworthy trees that are going to be irreplaceable, either due to their size or their location or their size and stature and condition, there are treatments, systemic treatments, that have proven to be effective at preserving the trees and keeping them from being affected. Clearly, that won't be feasible at a broader landscape level, but for individual trees or groups of trees in an urban setting, that is one of the strategies that we have that we can take advantage of. Also, early detection is going to be imperative or critical. So we're asking folks if they have ash trees and if they see some dieback. The best thing to do is read up on it, familiarize oneself with the signs and symptoms of emerald ash borer, and if you have any concerns, reach out to a tree professional so that it can be diagnosed early. If signs are visible, as long as it's not too far advanced, trees can be treated, but also the cost of removal can often be less if a tree has not reached the advanced stages of infection. So they become rather brittle, and they can't be climbed, and removal costs go up. So early detection and rapid response is going to be key in this effort.
All right. Anything else that people need to know that you can speak to this morning about the emerald ash borer or the future of our ash trees here in Oregon?
Finish by saying that numerous communities back east are at the tail end of this situation, and it's been the most destructive forest pest in U.S. history in terms of the economics of the situation and the number of trees impacted. So I think it's really critical that we take this problem seriously, and if we do so and engage experts early on and follow through with plans, I think we'll make it through, just like the other communities have. And we have the luxury of learning the lessons that those early communities didn't have anything to draw on. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We can learn the lessons that they learned the hard way and hopefully simplify things that way.
All right. And you're a tree guy, so I'm going to mm-hmm. ask you to use your great powers of description and knowledge of the tree mm-hmm. to describe the Oregon ash to someone who has never seen one.
Great question. So I'll start down at the trunk of the tree. To my eye, the bark of an Oregon ash looks a lot like an oak tree. So if folks are familiar with, say, our Oregon white oak, the bark looks similar. The locations that ash grow, they tend to be near waterways or in wetlands. They have a specialty. They can grow in areas that other trees have a hard time growing in. So they've staked out their claim in some of the heavier clay soils and wetlands and riparian areas that other trees struggle to grow in. The leaves are distinct. They're a compound leaf, and the branch structure is somewhat unique too. I will say, from an aesthetic standpoint, our native ash tree isn't that great to look at. It's not a really showy tree. It often has brown foliage that is a cosmetic issue only. But a compound leaf and a very light crown, so it's not a heavy, dense shade that the crowns cast. That's about as well as I could do without photos and such for the average person.
And that's good enough for us on the Oregon ash tree and also the emerald ash borer, a creature that's causing its fair share of issues here in our state. Big thanks to Scott Altenhoff with the Oregon Department of Forestry and to KXL's John Eric Smith for that interview. You have been listening to Beyond the Headlines, a behind-the-scenes look at some of this week's stories. You can follow me on Twitter, at Brett Recamp. If you missed anything, the podcast is good to go at KXL.com, and you can download the show on iTunes or Google Play. Just look for Beyond the Headlines, KXL. We now have 427 shows to choose from. For Alpha Media USA in downtown Portland, I'm Brett Recamp on FM News 101.
This has been Beyond the Headlines. In-depth interviews on topics of concern here in Portland and the Northwest. This has been a special presentation of Alpha Media.